Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we hear a lecture by Michael Barber, a senior advisor to British Prime Minister Tony Blair, on school inspection, accountability, and the design of school systems. As head of the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit, Barber oversees health, education, and other public service sectors. Part of his responsibility is to oversee school inspections, which are an integral part of school accountability in England. Introducing Mr. Barber is Charles Glenn, Professor of Education at Boston University and a former state education official. We begin with opening remarks from Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
This evening we will have a chance to explore why school inspection, a feature of educational policy in Britain and across Europe, is the most efficient means of promoting high standards in public schools. School inspectors go beyond student evaluations, test data, and curricular review, although they could and do employ all these means and more. School inspectors are teachers charged with visiting a school and reporting on what they see. We had a chance to witness their careful observations in February of 1997, when we invited a team of British school inspectors under the leadership of Ray Shostak, to do a sample review of the John F. Kennedy School in Boston. We had planned to expand this program by inviting British inspectors to train Massachusetts teachers in their methods, and then charge our own inspectors with reviewing one-fifth of the state schools each year. Although we were not able to get this program enacted, an anemic version of it lives on in the reviews administered to charter schools in the Commonwealth, about as inadequate as reviews could be. I look forward to tonight's lecture and am deeply grateful to the Center for School Improvement for bringing to the School of Education and the University a distinguished lecture series named in honor of our distinguished colleague as Dean Emeritus Edmund de Latre.
Good evening. My name is Charles Glenn. Michael Barber has the fascinating title of head of the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit, which I originally took to mean that he was the in-residence obstetrician at number 10 Downing Street. But it turns out his responsibility, and it's a fascinating role really, is to ensure that the various social programs enacted by the Parliament are carried out effectively, that is, to ride herd on the various agencies, the various government agencies, which have responsibility for carrying them out, and to be sure that the results, not only in education, but in a range of other social areas, are met. He comes to that with the excellent experience of having been in charge of the effort in England and Wales, which I think anticipated many of the things we have tried to do in the United States in recent years, made many mistakes and learned from many of those mistakes to set clear standards and to hold schools accountable for meeting those standards within a context of flexibility about how the schools would go about doing it. England has much more experience now than we do with this effort, which we're just trying painfully to get off the ground. Before that, he had been an official in the National Union of Teachers and therefore knows from the inside the issues of the sometimes in this country adversarial relationship between teachers' unions and reform efforts. He has worked both sides of the street, in a sense, and before that was a secondary school teacher. Michael Barber.
Thank you very much indeed for that kind introduction. I'm also grateful for the invitation to lecture on the subject of inspection and accountability, because it provided me with a wonderful opportunity to reflect on subjects which have been a huge part of my working life over the last 15 years. My argument has five elements. I want to, first of all, make the case for accountability, I then want to talk about the relationship of accountability to the wider redesign of the system, which we're attempting to bring about in England. Then talk about the role of inspection within the accountability system. And then my fourth section looks at how the inspection system works in broad terms and how it might need to be changed. And then the final section looks at the substantial reform of the inspection system that we're taking forward at the moment and sets it in the context of a wider debate that we in England tend to call the next stage of reform. So those are the five themes I'm going to go through. The rise of accountability, starting on the first section, began in the 1980s, and it's probably the single most important development in education policy in the last generation, I would argue, certainly in England, and probably in the United States too, and indeed many other countries, Sweden, Russia, Australia, New Zealand, and Holland, to mention a few. And that rise of accountability arose out of two strands. One, there was a political frustration with the development of education systems and their inability, as it seemed to the politicians of the time, to prepare young people for the emerging global economy. But at the same time, within the education research community, the development of school effectiveness data and school effectiveness research, allied later to school improvement research, demonstrated that schools did indeed make a difference, that individual teachers did indeed make a difference. So there was an intellectual rationale provided out of the education system which fed the politicians' frustration with the inadequacies of the education systems in the kinds of countries I've mentioned. The school effectiveness work, I think, is the most important development in education research over the last 30 years. One of the reasons for that is that it saw off that mind-numbing philosophy of the 1960s and 70s that all education outcomes were socially determined and that education systems could do no more than replicate existing inequalities. So right from the outset of accountability systems, it faced educators with a real dilemma. On the one hand, it was liberating and actually quite exhilarating to discover that one's actions had a profound impact and made a profound difference. But it's also very daunting to be held to account for that awesome responsibility. The business literature, if you step outside of education for a while, is clear on the benefits of accountability. At its simplest, and it's in pretty much all of the business books you care to read, what accountability in business requires is that people know what their goals are, they know that progress towards those goals is going to be measured, and they know that success will be rewarded and failure addressed. And we know from repeated evidence that that delivers results, which is hardly a surprise because actually it's no more than organised common sense. But accountability in education was controversial for two reasons that don't necessarily arise in the business field. One reason it was controversial is that when politicians embarked on establishing accountability within education systems, what they were in fact also doing was wresting control from the teaching profession that in many education systems had been ceded to teachers in the immediate post-war era. And so there was a power struggle over the content and processes of education. But the other reason accountability was controversial in education is that the goals of education themselves are matters of controversy. And there are many people in England, including a leading philosopher by the name of Honora O'Neill, who argue that because some of the goals of education are very hard to measure, it's a mistake to measure any of them. It's a commonly held view. It's one I personally don't agree with. There are many, many goals of education you can measure. And as for the other ones, you'll see later that inspection, in my view, plays a part there. Either way, over about a decade between, say, A Nation at Risk and Teaching Quality in the early 80s, one in America and one in England, over the decade that followed, the arguments for accountability tended to become more or less triumphant. And that was often bruising for people in the teaching profession. But as I will argue in a minute, it was actually the absence of accountability that was destructive of the long-term interests of teachers. There's a lot of debate, no doubt, in the US as well, but in England, about teacher morale. In my view, the low point for teacher morale in England was the early to mid-1980s, in other words, before accountability was established, at a time when the system was suffering from very, very severe spending pressures, falling roles, and controversy without any real action or direction. Actually, since accountability was introduced, there's been a lot of progress made on those issues. So if the virtue of accountability, if the introduction of accountability has actually been positive for teachers, it's also worth setting out what the benefits are more generally. First of all, for citizens, it's resulted undoubtedly in much better information about the quality of the education system, both about individual schools, individual local authorities, and the system as a whole. Secondly, it's provided citizens with evidence of progress. They can actually see that the investment made, their taxes being invested in the education system, are or are not, in some cases, delivering results, but they can see the evidence. And generally, over the last decade in England, they have seen evidence of real progress. Because the third benefit is accountability does deliver better results. Holding people to account for results does improve performance. It's not perfect, it's not even, it's not always consistent, but over a 10-year period, it's been steady and very, very significant. The other benefit it's delivered in England, and this obviously depends on the design of the accountability system, is greater equity. And I'll make the argument for that in a moment. But I also want to point out that accountability has had huge benefits for teachers. First of all, it's clarified their purpose. One of the reasons teachers often felt undermined and threatened and demoralised in the early 1980s was that they felt they were being given responsibility for all the ills of society. And indeed, society often thought that maybe that's what they should be doing. But accountability for clearly specified goals changes that. It gives a clear purpose. It enables schools to establish a clear mission. The second benefit for teachers is it's demonstrated to the public what they are actually delivering. It's demonstrated to the public that teachers make a difference. It's often argued, and has been argued in England at moments of controversy, that some of the interventions by the system in individual failing schools is in some ways an attack on the teaching profession. In fact, the opposite is true. When a system takes school failure seriously, the statement it's making to the public is that schools matter, that teachers matter, and that getting good schools and good teachers is an important and noble goal for a society. The third benefit for teachers is the introduction of accountability, and therefore the accumulation of data about what works, is the underpinning of a new informed professionalism. Because there's so much more evidence about what works, about what the best ways of organising a school are, the best ways of leading and managing a school, the best ways of teaching in the classroom, that actually the profession as a whole can learn much more rapidly and much more effectively. The other benefit, often not mentioned, but very, very important about accountability systems, is they enable both the citizens and indeed teachers and others who work within education systems to hold the government to account. I had the good fortune for 4 years of working for the Secretary of State for Education in the first Blair term, David Blunkett, who was a wonderful and inspired politician, very, very committed to improving the education service. Towards the end of his time in office, just before the 2001 election, we were reflecting on what the successes and failures were of that four-year period, and there were a mixture that we referred to. But one of the points we hit upon that I think is very, very significant was that David Blunkett was the first education secretary in the history of our country whose performance was judged by how well the school pupils did in their exams and tests. He was the first one to be held to account for delivering improved student performance. Before that, they were judged by the quality of their legislation or the lack of it, by the amount of money they spent or the lack of it, by the length of time they stayed in office or the lack of it. But after David Blunkett, every education secretary will be held to account for the results, just like everybody else in the education system. It's a very, very important and significant development in the politics of the public services. I want to argue that accountability is critical to the salvation of the public services in an era when the public in pretty much every developed country is impatient for results. Why is that the case? And this is, I think, the clinching argument for accountability systems. What accountability systems do is put in place a virtuous circle in the relationship between teachers and the public. The teachers have clear roles provided to them by government representing the public. The teachers are then able to make progress for the reasons that I've just given in delivering against those goals. And the public are able to see that progress and therefore they feel justified in continuing to invest through their taxes in the development of the education system. If you go back to the mid-1980s, before accountability, teachers, and I spoke to many when I worked with Alan Evans, who's in the audience this evening at the teacher union. The teachers felt misunderstood, but the public felt, what on earth are they doing? There was a complete divide between what the teachers, how the teachers felt and what the society was expecting, whereas the accountability system has reconnected teachers with the public, and it's out of that relationship that the big investments in education have come over the last 8 years. It is inconceivable that we in England will be in the sixth year of significant economic growth in education if we hadn't had accountability in place. It would have been impossible to justify those huge investments, both revenue and capital, into the education system without the accountability system in place. For teacher unions, this has been a huge question to reflect upon. In the days when Alan and I worked at the National Union of Teachers in the late 80s and I then into the early 90s, in essence, our argument was you need to invest in the education system and then we'll deliver results. But actually what worked, it turns out, was the education system said, look, we're delivering results, now invest in us. And it was turning the argument on its head that actually turned round the opportunities for the education system. And Alan and I and many others, not just in the NUT but in other teacher unions around the world, were groping towards that justification in the late 80s. But it was only when it came into place, actually as a result more of government action than teacher union action, that the big investments have followed. Because actually taxpayers are willing to invest in success. They're much less willing to invest, like the rest of us for that matter, in failure. And so for public service workforces and their leaders, we had a period of about 30 years when the rational strategy for getting money was to complain about how bad everything was. Police people said crime's getting out of control. Hospital doctors said hospitals were dirty, falling down, and people were dying. Teachers said children were unruly, parents were irresponsible, and the school roof was leaking. And all or some of those were true at any given moment. But as a form of argument for investment, all it did was periodically, usually in the run-up to an election, persuade politicians to spend some money to get the public service workforce off their backs. Now we're in the sixth year of an 8 or possibly 10 year period of economic growth. If you keep making the same argument that the roof's falling in, crime's out of control and so on, actually what you're saying to the public is, although you're spending all this money on the system, it's still not working, even though the objective results are going in the right place. And so while accountability's brought some sobering realities to government, it also brings some sobering realities to public sector leadership. And I want to talk, before I go into any more detail on that, about how the accountability system works. I want to place it in the context of the overall system. First of all, accountability is part of a system or a framework for managing performance. And this framework has 6 segments, and the idea is that the combination of them will generate continuous improvement in schools. The first is, through the national curriculum, high standards are set. So it's very clear what the expectations are in the 10 subjects, or in Wales, the 11 subjects of the national curriculum are. The second crucial segment is the devolution of funding and responsibility to schools. So roughly 90% of all funding for the school system is devolved to schools to be deployed by head teachers in consultation with the school's governing body. And they can choose what combination of staff to have, how many teachers, how many other staff. They can choose how many computers to buy, how many books to buy, and what combination they want. So that's devolved responsibility. The third segment says, now schools know what the standards are, and they've got the money and the responsibility. They need to know how well they're doing. And so through the testing system, we're able to generate comparative data, which is then distributed to every school, and enables each school to compare its own performance, not just to every other school in the system and in its own locality, but to other schools like it, to other schools with similar intakes. And that data, when we first distributed it, was quite good and is now very good, and it's getting better. The data also enables the system to identify best practices, to identify what works, to use Tony Blair's favourite term. And the investment in professional development that's been made over the last 6 to 8 years enables the system then to train and develop teachers in the adoption of those best practices. So, for example, we have major programs for school leadership. We've had major programs for teaching literacy in primary school and now secondary school, the same in numeracy and so on. So you can identify through the data best practices, and some of those can become system-wide change programs. Having set high standards, devolved responsibility, enable schools to know how well they're doing, and put in place a system whereby the system as a whole can learn, it's right that schools should be held to account. And they're held to account in two ways. First of all, by the publication of test results in league table form, and secondly, by the inspection system. And I'll come back to both those in a moment. And finally, those schools that are succeeding can be rewarded with leadership positions in the education system. Those that are struggling heroically in difficult circumstances can be assisted. And those that are evidently underperforming, the failure can be tackled and addressed. So that simple performance management system emerged out of the conservative reforms of the early 90s and was put in place, I think, with reasonable coherence by the first Blair government, and is still operational, though each aspect of it is constantly in a process of refinement. But it's important to see that in the context of the wider reform model. So if you have the performance management framework in the middle, on the left-hand side as you look at it, there are various programs being introduced to encourage collaboration and capacity building. So there's a National College for School Leadership. There's investment in continuous professional development. There's encouragement of networks of schools around particular themes, and so on. I won't go through the whole list. The system certainly needs collaboration, and some of those collaborative methods are working and some of them aren't, and the system's still got more to learn about how to do that. But it's a crucial part of ensuring the success of the education system. On the other side of the triptych, you have the market forces, which again were introduced first by the 1988 Conservative Education Reform Act and have since been reformed and refined, but not reduced in their impact. And so there is the opportunity for parents to choose between schools. There is a pupil-led funding formula, which means the money follows the pupil. There is open enrollment encouraging schools to recruit up to their full capacity. There is some degree of market exit and entry, with poor schools being closed and sometimes replaced, though that's an area where the reform could go much further. And city academies are an example of encouraging market entry by creating the circumstances in which various sponsors, either from the business sector or other parts of the education sector or wherever, can establish new schools, particularly in areas where the current school system isn't sufficiently effective and so on. But you can see that accountability is part of a performance management framework, and that in turn is part of a wider approach to reform. Now let me talk about how the accountability system works. There is a set of tests and public exams in England, and roughly these are what is tested. So age seven, there are tests in English and mathematics. They're not externally set and marked any longer, although they're clearly benchmarked. The results of those are not published in league tables, and the benchmark level that you're aiming for is level two of the national curriculum. National curriculum's in eight levels, one to eight, through from five to 16. At age 11, which is the end of primary school in England, there are externally set and marked tests in English, maths and science, and the results of those are indeed published in league tables, and the benchmark level is level four, which in American terms you'd call proficient. It means being able to read and write well. It's not just basic reading and writing, and the same in mathematics. At age 14, the pattern is similar, although we had IT in at that point. And then at age 16, pupils are making choices about exams that they take, and the benchmark for age 16 is five higher grades in any subjects. So that's the testing system and how it works. It's still fiercely contested that the results of those tests should be published in league tables, and the argument made against league tables has three elements which I want to raise. One is that by focusing it on these subjects alone, particularly well up to the age of 14 anyway, it narrows the curriculum. And of course, in one sense, that's entirely true. You could put the same point in different words. You could say it encourages prioritisation. That's what it does. It encourages people to prioritise English, maths and science. And the reason it does that is that English, maths and science are more important. We know, for example, that English performance at age 11 is the best predictor of performance in any subject age 16. In other words, English is a better predictor of performance age 16 in science than science age 11 is of science at 16. So these subjects are actually more important. So you can argue that it narrows the curriculum. What it does certainly is it prioritises. In my view, actually, we don't yet prioritise English and mathematics sufficiently, particularly at primary school level and in the early years of secondary. But I quite often meet secondary head teachers who leave arrangements in place where children who are age 12 and 3 or 4 years behind their chronological reading age are still being taught exactly the same curriculum as everybody else and falling further and further behind. And no wonder you end up with behaviour problems and truancy problems. When you ask them why that's the case, they say doing anything different would cause timetabling problems. In other words, they're putting administrative convenience ahead of educational need and aspiration. There are other secondary schools that have taken that and turned it round and completely transformed the way they do that because they understand the importance of literacy. The second argument used against league tables is about raw results being unfair. If you publish a benchmark level, in other words, at age 11, the percentage getting level 4, obviously for some schools in some areas, that's a much harder thing to achieve than for other schools in other areas. So at face value, it does look unfair. So one response the government has done to that is to also publish value-added data, the progress children have made age 7 to 11, or the progress they've made age 11 to 14 or 11 to 16, using increasingly individual pupil-level data so that you're actually tracking individual pupils and taking account of when pupils leave one school and go to another. And that's a good step forward, I think. But I think there's a principled argument for raw results, which often gets neglected, and it's this. By publishing raw results, you're actually promoting equity because you focus the effort and resource on those schools facing the greatest challenge. By publishing raw results, you force the system to say, we've got to do something about those schools that are way behind the rest. And that drives the resource to the schools that need it most. It is inconceivable that schools down the bottoms of the league table on raw results would be getting the assistance, the investment, and indeed the rate of improvement they're getting now if we hadn't published raw results over the last 10 years. The third argument that gets used against league tables is that there are some goals you can't measure. I mentioned it earlier. And actually, this is entirely true. There are some goals you can't measure through tests and exams. That is absolutely right. And it's at that point that the inspection system becomes an absolutely fundamental part of the accountability system. The inspection system does indeed measure the crucial wider goals of education. It doesn't just measure progress in academic subjects. It measures other things. But I want to make the case more broadly for inspection before I come back to the details of how the system works. One of the huge benefits of inspection if you're in government implementing a program is that you can get from the inspection system early information on whether your program is working. If you invent a program and you don't have an inspection system and you have to wait to see what happens to the test results, you may have to wait 1 year, 2 years, 3 years to see whether your policy is effective. And if it turns out at the end of that time that it's ineffective, actually, it's going to be too late to fix it. When we introduced the National Literacy Strategy in September 1998, I was, as the person responsible, very keen to find out whether it was working pretty fast. And in November 98, so 8 weeks or 9 weeks after it had been introduced, I got together a group of inspectors who'd spent the last 2 months in primary schools and spent 3 hours just listening to them and asking them questions. I knew then that the program was beginning to work. I also knew then that there were some small things that I could fix right away. And I did that, and we used that as a process all the way through. Without the inspection system, I would have been relying on other things. I would have been visiting schools as I did, and that would have given me some feedback. I'd have been talking to teachers. I'd have been talking to other representatives of the teaching profession. I would have learned something, but I wouldn't have had the objective view that the inspection system gave me. Third benefit of inspection, particularly if you see it from a government point of view, I'm putting it in fairly blunt terms here, is it acts as an enforcement mechanism. The National Literacy Strategy was built around a single literacy hour, a one-hour lesson based on best practice and a framework that taught the sequence of literacy in which it should be, or set out the sequence of in which literacy should be taught. We didn't mandate that in law. What we did is say, here's a set of frameworks based on best practice. Here's some training that will enable you to use the framework and teach the literacy hour. And you can choose in your school whether you do this. But if you choose something else and it works less well than the national literacy strategy, then the inspectors are going to find out. And they're going to hold you to account in a literal sense. They're going to say, why are you doing that? So the inspection system is a very useful lever for encouraging the adoption of evidence-based programs. Fourthly, it's enabled school failure to be tackled effectively. Most of the American systems that I've read about for intervening in failing schools rely almost purely on the test results, the test outcomes, which is a very crude mechanism for making some judgments which have enormous significance. But our school failure interventions are based on Ofsted inspections. The school is inspected. If it's found to be, as the euphemism has it, in need of special measures, that's the legal phrase, then a second inspection team goes a few weeks later and checks, and only after that does the intervention proceed. And what you get, therefore, is not just a statement the school is failing, but an analysis of why, and two groups of inspectors' judgments corroborated before the action ensues. And then the other benefit of inspection, which I mentioned in relation to testing, is that the inspection system holds government to account. Our inspection agency inspects government programs. I can remember the same trembling feeling that no doubt some head teachers have had when some of my programs were subject to inspection by Ofsted and the report is published and you have to defend yourself in public. But I also know this, it made me design programs more effectively. The original model of Ofsted comes out of the 1992 legislation, which was put through by the Conservative government with Labour support at that time. And what it did was to take an existing traditional organisation, Her Majesty's Chief Inspector, and put the Chief Inspector in charge of an office called Ofsted, which is the Office for Standards in Education. And Ofsted had a responsibility for introducing an inspection system that would enable every school to be inspected within 4 years. It didn't do all the inspections itself, it contracted them out, but it was responsible for ensuring the quality of those inspections and managing the implementation of the process. And so various companies, but also local education authorities, developed inspection teams. They had to have a chief inspector for each of the inspection teams called the registered inspector, and that person was trained and held to account for the quality of the inspections. Inspection took place against an inspection framework, and I'll take you through that in a moment. And the report, the head teacher then received report at the end of the inspection. So for a big secondary school, a team of inspectors would spend a week there, might be about 40 inspector days in total over the period of 5 days. And at the end of the inspection, on the last day, they would provide oral feedback to the head teacher. And then a few weeks later, when the inspectors had written their report, that would be published and a summary distributed to every parent. The framework is basically a definition, which is broadly shared by people in the education system, of what a good school should look like. And it has four elements: the standards being achieved by the pupils, the quality of teaching, the quality of leadership and management, and then what we rather quaintly in Britain call the social, moral, spiritual and cultural aspect of the school, which is basically those wider goals that I referred to earlier. The inspection takes place in those four sections and a report is written in those four sections. And just to give you one example, the data accumulated out of this is collected in a national database, and we can actually show from the Ofsted database the improvements in the quality of teaching over the last 8 or 9 years. So when they started out on inspection, about 20% of lessons were found to be, to use their phrase, unsatisfactory, and now it's down to less than 5%. Now, there may be some slippage in the standards, but the basic trend is undoubted. So this system is also providing really effective data. Now, over the years since 1992, that inspection system went through a series of developments largely associated with the different chief inspectors. So the first inspector was a quietly spoken vice-chancellor, now largely forgotten, called Stuart Sutherland. His successor was a man called Chris Woodhead, who will never be forgotten, and I'm going to mention again in a minute. And then since then, there have been Mike Tomlinson and David Bell. It was Chris Woodhead that put this inspection system on the map. He did so by courting controversy. He made his name by saying there were probably 15,000 failing teachers in the system. He goaded people in university departments to argue with him. He attacked local education authorities. He focused very firmly on literacy and numeracy and on school failure. And as a result of all these things, he became a figure of enormous controversy. He was a huge influence for good over the period that he was chief inspector, because he did stick to those priorities. He did say things that other people only thought, and he did consistently drive away at literacy and numeracy and dealing with school failure. And through that period, even though it was ups and downs, as far as I was concerned, we were allies in taking those things forward. Let me just give you one example. In 1997, this is secondary school, there were 616, so that's about a fifth of all schools in England, and where fewer than 25% of pupils achieved the standard that we set for age 16 performance. So there were 616 schools where fewer than a quarter of the pupils achieved the standard. By last year, that was down to 154 schools. There has been a systematic eking away in reducing the number of schools with low performance. And Ofsted, along with the rest of the accountability system, identified the problem. They put it out in the open, and that transparency forced government to find ways of solving those problems, community by community, city by city, and indeed across the country. It's a very, very significant achievement, which would have been impossible without Ofsted. I now want to talk briefly about how the inspection system will develop in future and the place it will have in the education system of the next few years. Under Mike Tomlinson and David Bell, Chris Woodhead's successors, the temperature has certainly been reduced, the rhetoric's much less flamboyant, there have been modifications of the process. For example, the principle of proportionality was introduced, where the inspection itself was altered according to whether your last inspection report was a good one or a bad one. You got a longer gap between them if the last inspection was good. You got a shorter, lighter touch inspection if the data plus your last inspection report were good. And there were other modifications of the framework that I mentioned earlier. But on the whole, the system ground on. But also in the last few years, there's been a growing realisation of the weaknesses of the current inspection system, as well as the strengths. One is that it had and does, but certainly in the beginning, generated too much bureaucracy. Schools were given quite a lot of notice of the inspection. They spent a huge amount of time preparing for it, writing policy documents, painting the windows, asking the children to turn up in their uniform, whatever it might be. There were a lot of bureaucratic requirements, or schools felt there to be a lot of bureaucratic requirements. A second one was, inevitably, that involved a distraction from the main task of teaching children. A third problem was there were issues of consistency about Ofsted. Although Ofsted had quite good, and sometimes very good, quality assurance mechanisms, it was hard to get consistency both in the judgments that inspectors made, but also in the way they wrote reports up. One of the frustrations I had sometimes with Ofsted was that the inspection teams were behind the cutting edge. In any system, education or otherwise, the best practice is somewhere at the cutting edge in the best-led organisations. And the Ofsted inspectors, largely worthy but not necessarily brilliant educators who made up the teams, were sometimes behind that cutting edge. And so they'd see a literacy hour, for example, and not recognise it as a good literacy hour. So it could become a drag on the system. Then there was the problem that the reports got dated. So if you were a good school, you got a good report, and you weren't going to be inspected again for 6 years, but that report was on the internet, and for parents making school choices, they were often looking at very dated information on those inspection reports. And finally, there was the cost. Although Ofsted inspection, I think, is relatively cheap at the price for its impact, we now have a government drive right across all the inspection agencies and in all government departments to take money out of what is in effect an overhead on the system and put it into the schools or the hospitals or indeed the basic command units in the police. So there's an efficiency drive going on, and as part of that, Ofsted's expense will be significantly reduced. But the other reason why we needed to move on was that the system as a whole had moved on. The inspection system you needed for a system that was evidently underperforming and lacking direction is a different inspection system from the one you required for a system which is as it is now, which is evidently improving and much clearer about where it's heading. So David Bell, the current chief inspector, has plans for a major redesign of the inspection system, but that's taking place within a wider rethink of the next stage of reform. And that's what I want to conclude by looking at. Back in 2001, as part of an attempt to conceptualise the next stage of reform, I developed a concept called informed professionalism, which I first promoted in September of 2001. And it's become, even if people don't use the words, a pretty influential descriptor of the next phase of reform. And I just want to spend a minute or two explaining it. In the 1970s, when I was a teacher, when I started teaching, what we had was uninformed professional judgment. Government didn't prescribe much at all. We had a minister in the late 1970s who said that basically his job was just to clear the get as much money out of the treasury as he could and hang around until he was promoted. But the teacher in the classroom basically made it up. Now, many teachers did a good job of trying to inform themselves, but the system as a whole was uninformed. The system didn't have a capacity to learn. So there were good projects, great researchers, great writers, but the system as a whole wasn't learning. And then in the 1980s, when the politicians got frustrated in Britain, as in many other countries, with the lack of accountability and lack of progress, they began to prescribe things, but the system still hadn't begun to learn. So you got uninformed prescription. As it turned out, many of the prescriptions taken from other fields and brought into education actually worked quite well, but still the system was relatively uninformed. By the time Tony Blair was elected in 1997, we had nearly a decade of uninformed prescription, and so the system was learning more and becoming more and more informed. And in 1997, the then government made a very conscious decision to be centrally prescriptive on the basis of the best information we had. The National Literacy Strategy, the National Numeracy Strategy, how to deal with school failure, these were based on very, very clear information that had been developed by the system over the last decade. So the system had begun to learn, and in order to get a quick result, rapid progress, to build the confidence of the public, the government was unashamedly prescriptive. And it actually worked rather well in improving primary schools dealing with school failure, but it had its flaws. It's hard to generate teacher ownership of reform if you're prescribing it. It's hard to get the creativity at the front line if you're constantly prescribing it. And so the prospect for the 2000s, for the decade we're in now, was could you build on that, maintain the knowledge richness of the department, but actually get professional leadership of the next stage of reform, hence the concept of professional judgment. And the idea of informed professional judgment or informed professionalism is that what you want are school leaders who are armed with excellent data, who have access to professional development and best practice, who have very clear goals, who have transparency about their results, and who therefore themselves choose to lead the drive for further improvement. Well, informed professionalism, I've sometimes wondered if I mentioned it about 3 years too soon. One reason is that the informed prescription was only just beginning to work. A second one was that the concept of accountability, which is crucial to informed professionalism, is still not fully established and is still now a matter of controversy. And of course, there were many people who liked the concept of informed professionalism, but they emphasized the professionalism bit and tried to neglect the informed bit of it. They saw it as an opportunity to roll back the developments of the 1990s. And so the debate is still quite fierce. There are many, many head teachers who actually accept see the challenge that informed professionalism means, because it is a very challenging thing, because what you're saying is it's not just a head teacher's job to improve his or her own school, it's their collective job to lead the improvement of the system as a whole. So it's pushing a huge responsibility out, which of course is refreshing for some and daunting for others. What does this mean for the inspection system? Well, the first is that the new model, which is currently being piloted, so it's going to start this time, about September of next year, the new model will have these features. First of all, much shorter notice. Schools will only be told a day or two in advance that the inspectors are coming. Secondly, it will take as its starting point an annual school self-evaluation. So the schools will self-evaluate themselves using the Ofsted framework, and that will be the starting point. And the job of the inspectors will be to check if the self-evaluation itself is valid, or the first job of the inspectors. The inspection process will be much shorter and sharper, many fewer inspectors, smaller team, but a stronger team, because with fewer people, you can train them better. Fewer inspector days, they have to be really focused. What you're trying to get here is a shift, not as some people might see it, from a hard inspection system to a soft one. On the contrary, you're trying to get a shift from a blunt inspection system to a sharp one. And the framework, while it will be refined, will not be significantly different. That inspection system will fit into a new framework of accountability, and this is the final point I want to make. First of all, there's going to be an annual single conversation between the school and the system. So the system is currently, again, piloting and training up a range of people who will be called school improvement partners. They'll be real active current head teachers who are trained in this role, and they'll have a conversation with the school about what its future targets should be, but also about what discretionary funding that school should receive. One conversation that links together future performance and future funding. Secondly, we've just proposed a reform which will be introduced in April 2006, that each individual school will be given a 3-year budget. So from April 2006, each school will know its budget through into 2009, which means schools can plan ahead and set targets ahead. As part of the annual single conversation, they can refine and update that 3-year thinking. Results will continue to be published in league tables. It'll need strategic government, which I'll come back to. There'll be an annual school profile, so the school, which will be updated, will have the latest inspector's judgment, progress against benchmarks, progress on test results, and so on, plus the statements that the school wants to make about its vision of the future. Again, that's being piloted currently. The shorter SALPA inspection I mentioned, based on school self-evaluation, therefore a huge drive to further strengthen school leadership, because leadership in the informed professional judgment era will be a very sophisticated challenge. And then there's a kind of missing piece in the middle. And here I want to refer briefly to our health reforms. Our health reforms, which have delivered real progress in the last 3 years, and I've had the opportunity to see from my current job, are based on the assumption that financial incentives drive change. The professionals assume that, the government assumes that, and their discussion is about what the financial incentives should be, what they should be for, how much they should be. So there's real rewards for success. And indeed, you could say that in health what's happened is that informed professionalism pays. People get rewarded for being well-informed professionals who then deliver results. In education, when you mention financial incentives, people say they won't work, they won't be motivational, they'll be divisive. And then I think our health workers and education workers, not just from different sectors, but from different species, it can't really be all that different. So the incentives in education, they're very strong to avoid failure, as you've seen from what I've said, but they're not so strong for generating continuous year-on-year improvement. Increasingly, when I meet head teachers in successful schools, I find them saying to me, if we're going to set ambitious targets and achieve them, why aren't we going to be rewarded for that? And I think some answer to that question is going to be the key to getting the new framework of accountability to work. Making this work will provide a very significant challenge of leadership, both for teachers and for government. For government, the leadership challenge is to design programs that are evidence-based, to be strategic, to be consistent, to select a few priorities and stick to them, to be an advocate for the education service and for investment in the education service, and then when the money's available, to invest it. For teachers, the challenge is to bring about this cultural shift represented here. I've just picked a few terms to describe the old system, that you know, the sort of 1980s, early 90s system, to where we're heading. Now, just let me pick out a few of those words. In the old system, we all talked about equity, but whenever you looked at the big research studies, you found you weren't delivering it. Whereas once the data's out, and once the best practice is available and everything's transparent, you have to drive equity. You can't avoid it, because it's going to constantly be thrown at you by the evidence. The old system was driven by regulation. In many ways, it still is. But the new one will need to be driven by incentives. And I won't go through all of them. Let me just take you to the bottom one, the old system, people looked up the hierarchy. So a head teacher looked to the chief education officer of the local education authority, which looked to the Department for Education. The chief education officer back in the 1980s would think, if they needed more money for their school, why don't I take the chief education officer out for lunch? The new system is about looking outwards. It's not about the head teacher looking up the hierarchy. It's about the head teacher or the school principal, to use an American term, looking out to the community it serves. What do I need to do for this community, for these students, these parents? They're the people who will drive the change in my system. The old system, for all its failings, was quite a comfortable place to work, relatively. Had its ups and downs. I remember it well, having worked in it myself. And I often pondered, why was it quite comfortable? Well, partly because the challenge was unclear, but mainly because there was always someone else to blame. You could always say, if you were in a school, it's the local education authority, or if you were in a teacher union, it's the government, or if you're the government, it's the teacher unions. Everybody pointed fingers at everybody else. And so while you knew it was kind of muddling along, not really working very well, everybody could find somebody else, reasonably credibly, that they could blame. This system will be very demanding. Why will it be demanding? Because the data's public, the challenge is clear, and the demands for higher standards will be insistent. But it will also be very rewarding. Why will it be rewarding? Because that system will actually succeed. It will make progress over time. It is already beginning to make progress over time. And in that process of transformation illustrated here, which is by no means complete, Ofsted inspection will certainly have a major part to play. Thank you very much for your attention.
Michael Barber, a senior advisor to British Prime Minister Tony Blair, speaking on school inspection, accountability, and the design of school systems. Barber's presentation was sponsored by the Center for School Improvement at Boston University. We also heard from Charles Glenn, professor of education at Boston University, and from Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD or a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Michael Garth, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.